All right, the third case on the oral argument calendar is George Tonnery, I assume I pronounced that correctly, versus Armitage and Cocopelli, case number 58321. Mr. Gentile, Mr. Stovall, ready to go?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, prior to starting, with the court's permission, Anjali Webster will do the rebuttal portion of our argument.
Okay.
If it please the court, my name is Dominic Gentile. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiffs below, the appellants here. To get directly to it, I would like to approach this in terms of the chronology of events at the trial court so that we can clarify why, absolutely under no set of circumstances, were we not entitled to go to the jury with the evidence that we had. And I hope, as part of that, to demonstrate that the evidence was sufficient to support the verdict that the jury returned. At the threshold, in the court's order granting the new trial, it made a statement at page 2626 of the appendix, and I'm reading from lines 3 through 6. The plaintiff failed to present a reasonable basis for Dr. Tonnery's claim that he incurred $30,000 in damages per month as a result of Dr. Stacy and Mr. Armitage's departure from the Specialty Medical Center, and failed to present a reasonable basis for the jury to divide the claimed loss of $30,000 per month between Dr. Stacy and Mr. Armitage. Your Honors, we never asked for $30,000 a month. At no time. When Dr. Tonnery testified in the case in chief, Dr. Tonnery was asked the question as to what he estimated his losses to be. He responded $30,000 a month. Never again throughout that entire trial was that number brought up. The way we proved the case at the 50A stage was through the testimony of Dr. Tonnery, who was an experienced practitioner and operator of a medical clinic, and through the testimony of Mr. Hightower, that Dr. Tonnery purchased Desert Trails from and who had 30 years' experience in the management of clinics. And the testimony that we relied on at that stage was the profit margin and Mr. Hightower's testimony that there are two component parts to how you make money in the medical business. You make it from the doctor or medical component, and you make it from ancillary or diagnostics component. At the close of our case in chief, and I'm reading from page 1528 of the appendix, line 7. The court said, I can tell you right now, as far as their argument on evidence of damages is concerned, there are at least nominal damages, so you get to go to the jury on nominal damages. Between you and me, if I was deciding this as a bench trial, I wouldn't accept Dr. Tonnery's guesstimate of $30,000 per month. Well, the jury is going to have to decide that, but I'm not about to decide that $30,000 a month just off the top of his head is a fair amount. He went at the next page to say the bottom line is, I wouldn't have accepted $30,000 just because he says it. I don't know if this jury will either. I have a serious problem upholding a substantial verdict on damages for breach of contract in this case. I'm sure you'll come up with something. We did. When the defense case in chief came about, they called a Mr. Iglinski, who basically was a summary witness of documents that we provided during the course of discovery. The specific exhibit in the record is DDD, three Ds. It was a group, triple C, triple D, triple E. Triple C was never viewed by the jury, but triple D was permitted to be called from triple C. In triple C, at page 271 of the, and I don't know why we designated it this way, but we designated it as the reply appendix. At 271, specifically at line 7 through 14, It was Mr. Iglinski, upon being examined by Mr. Stovall's father, not this Mr. Stovall, that said that as with respect to Dr. Stacy, the collections for her 9 months of service were $217,877.86. By the time this case went to the jury and during the summation in this case, not once did we talk about a $30,000 loss. What we did was we took the testimony of Mr. Iglinski, we divided it by nine, and came with a monthly collection figure, and told the jury that is not the damages. If you take the collection and you multiply it by the number of months that she should have been there, and if you don't increase it, let's say that, and we asked the jury this, we told the jury this, don't increase it, leave it static, but recognize that she would have made more money as time goes on, so give her increases in pay. And projected over the 50.8 months, deduct the interest in pay from that figure. Now, we all know that from an accounting standpoint, you don't make those deductions until you get your gross. But we told them to make it then and there so that it was a more conservative number. And then deduct the compensation from the collections and then apply the 20% factor to the resulting number. So it was a very conservative request that we made. We never asked for $30,000 a month. That would have been $1,524,800. What we did ask for is $608,900. And we based it entirely upon the calculation that I just spoke to you about. You will find that in the record at Appendix 2249 through 2254.
What I'm missing, Mr. Gentile, is the component of 20%.
That was the testimony of Dr. Tonori. Dr. Tonori operated his clinic. We submitted tax returns. They had those. And his testimony was that 20% was the figure. And I believe that Mr. Hightower was asked if that was a reasonable figure. And I think he said that it was. But I, you know what? I'm just going on memory on that one. But that's where the 20% calculation came from. That having been said, there was plenty of evidence in this case to get past both the 50A and the 50B. And I submit to the court that because of the way it was presented to the jury, a reasonable mind could accept it as support for their conclusion. Here's why. Number one, you don't have to have an expert witness. No case holds that you have to have an expert witness. When we get into the three cases that Mr. Stovall relies upon, Maynard and the other two, first of all, they were not similar to this case, and they were very complicated calculations that had to be made in those cases. And candidly, even in those cases, they probably didn't have to, as a matter of law, have an expert. In this case, this is simple contract law. This is simple arithmetic. In fact, Mr. Iglinski even testified to that in his direct examination by Mr. Stovall. So by the time you get to the 50B stage, you have to look at all of the evidence that came into the case, not just what the plaintiff did in his case in chief. And I submit to you that at that stage, if you take a look at instruction number 47, if instruction number 47 is given in every case that takes place in this state, whether it be criminal or civil. And instruction number 47 is the one that tells the jury that you may draw reasonable inferences from the evidence which you feel are justified in the light of common experience. Now, we were dealing here with a And the law is the law all over Nevada. But Dr. Tonori and this trial and the defendants in this case were from a small community. And during the jury selection in this case, everybody knew everybody. All the parties were known by everybody on the jury because most of them, they were their doctors. credibility was an issue in this case, and there's no question about it. And Mr. Stovall, the trial Mr. Stovall, assailed Dr. Tonori's credibility heavily. Now, I submit to you that this was a common sense verdict by this jury. You know, if they would have returned a verdict in excess of the $608,000 that we calculated by using this formula, I would not feel as strongly as I do about standing before you today and saying that a new trial, that the judge's ruling on a new trial was an abuse of discretion. I will say this. If you look at the order, the judge, Judge Thompson, who's a fine trial judge, and I'm not here to dispute that, he seemed to embrace this $30,000 number, and I don't know why. I don't know why, because it wasn't what was sought, it wasn't what was argued, and the testimony in the case, other than Dr. Tonori's single statement, there was no testimony in the case seeking, trying to prove a $30,000 per month loss in profits. Separate and apart from that, I think he's incorrect when he said that we didn't separate the liability between the two, because if you look at the summation, and specifically at 2256 of the appendix, when I'm addressing the jury in terms of what we were seeking from Mr. Armitage, at line 5, I said to the jury, so I have absolutely no qualms about standing before you and saying that this case is worth absolutely every nickel of the $150,000 liquidated damages breach and the calculations made here with respect to the expectancy as to Dr. Stacey. So we sought the liquidated damages of $150,000 against Mr. Armitage. That's not in front of you today because he declared bankruptcy, and so he's no longer part of this. But I think you need to consider that when you're considering whether this judge, at the time of granting the new trial, I don't want to say remembered the case. I want to say remembered what we were seeking. Because we did, in fact, distinguish the two. We sought $608,000 from Dr. Stacey, and we saw $150,000 from Mr. Armitage.
And the jury, again, just so I'm clear, what did they award to Mr. Armitage?
Against Armitage,
$275,000. Okay.
You know, I only sought the liquidated damages. Now, if you want, I will address the last portion, but really I think that my time is pretty much used. I'm sure Mr. Stovall will bring up the procedural issue, and Ms. Webster will address it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gentile. Mr. Stovall.
Good morning, Your Honors. Justin Stovall for the respondents. Having listened to Mr. Gentile explain his side of the story, it's difficult to respond to in the sense that I think that, first of all, Judge Thompson listened to the entire trial, right? And I think what most of this boils down to in terms of the sufficiency of Dr. Tonori's case was some of these issues that Mr. Gentile did not mention, which was the discovery issues. Now, Dr. Tonori has still not complied with the court's orders when it came to discovery. So that having been said, this case really boils down to Dr. Tonori wanting to have his cake and eat it too. That is to pursue his claims, but not to have to open his books. And, you know, I think the record is replete with this. So there's two issues. It was on this court synopsis, and that was in the briefs. The first was, did Judge Thompson err in granting a new trial? The second was, can the respondent argue JNOV on appeal? And I'll try to address each one with the equal amount of time here. I'd ask the court to keep in mind that as far as Judge Thompson granting a new trial in this case, the standard review is abuse of discretion. I know there are two standards of review that we're dealing with here because we raised the JNOV issue, and that would be de novo, but I'd ask the court to review Judge Thompson's decision as abuse of discretion first, and then move on to de novo for the JNOV if the court gets to that point. Mr. Gentile didn't dispute this, and I think as far as the jury instruction goes and as far as the appellant's briefs, all the parties agree that lost profits was the measure of damages for the awards that are in question. In that regard, the appellant appears to me to have made two arguments with regard to the sufficiency of the evidence. First of all, that they presented sufficient evidence of lost profits. However, they only point to Dr. Tenori's testimony, and I guess in this argument they also point to Mr. Hightower's testimony. I'll remind you, Judge Thompson listened to you the entire trial. He was aware of all of this testimony. You know, their expert got thrown out because, prior to trial, because Dr. Tenori was not open with his books. So even though Mr. Gentile can articulate some sort of theory as to how the jury could have arrived at their number, it was not based on reliable information because of these issues with Dr. Tenori not being willing to open up his books, which I think was Judge Thompson's issue. Since Mr. Gentile is presenting his thoughts about it, I want to do that as well. Specifically, Dr. Tenori only testified as to revenue. Now, I think if you look through our arguments, it becomes clear, even though we weren't able to find a case that I guess was directly on point, there's that Colorado Services case that says that revenue is only one part of the equation when it comes to reaching lost profits. What Dr. Tenori did not present was his costs. And it was impossible to come to an accurate formula with regards to revenue minus cost to get the lost profits because
well,
he wasn't.
I posed that question to Mr. Gentile. What I couldn't determine was this 20%. That equation was missing for me. Was there testimony from Dr. Tenori that his profit margin was 20%?
That I don't know. I don't know which particular part of the record, but that does actually. I don't know. Your Honor, is the best way to respond to that. I can't point to any part in the...
Well, if the record contained a testimony either from him or from Hightower, is Hightower the right name?
Mr. Hightower, yes.
Now, that there was a profit margin, would it... And the jury was provided with gross revenue numbers from some source... wouldn't that satisfy our standard for calculating damages, or would it be necessary to show costs in addition to that? I don't know that we've ever said that.
I'm not dodging the question by answering it this way, but Mr. Gentile, I believe, is correct by saying that we don't need an expert to calculate those, but we do need documentary evidence to support those. If not, it's just as... in our briefs, we cited some of Dr. Chorney's testimonies. It's just his expectation, you know.
Well, but the judge allowed Dr. Tenori to testify. Apparently, he imposed a sanction, from what you're saying, that excluded Dr. Tenori's expert because they hadn't provided the documentation. But he didn't exclude Dr. Tenori's testimony on damages. He allowed the jury to consider that.
Yeah.
So the sanction that he imposed for failure to produce the documents was the exclusion of the expert. Is that right?
No, I don't believe that's. I don't believe that's.
Can you
the case.
Clarify that?
The expert was excluded because his expert report relied on, I guess, geographical data that was not personal to Dr. Tenori, if that makes sense. Because Dr. Tenori, and still to this day, right, has not opened up his records to accurately reflect what his costs of doing business are. It's impossible to...
But did you make an objection to his testimony about revenue and profit projections based on the fact that he hadn't produced his records?
I don't want to misinform the court, but in everything that I read in reading through the entire record, I believe that the objections were made to Dr. Tenori's unsupported, I guess, opinion testimony about what his expectations would be. You know, the problem was is he didn't open
but apparently
up.
Apparently, the court overruled those objections and allowed that testimony to be provided.
The court overruled some of those objections to allow Mr. Tenori or Dr. Tenori to say what he was going to say. But ultimately, at the end of it, right, I believe that the court came to its conclusion because the jury was not able to get a reliable number, and I believe that's in the order, they were not able to get a reliable figure for the lost profits because the actual, because Dr. Tenori was not willing to open up his books and give give us and the court and the jury the accurate numbers.
As Mr. Gentile argues that the plaintiffs survived 50A, a 50A motion, so the jury heard and the case went to the jury on the entirety of the evidence, which included evidence that they obtained from Mr. Hightower. Is that right?
Yes. And I promise I'm not trying to dodge your questions, but I think that when you look at the breach of contract with the measure of damages, you can have the liability segment of it, just like in a negligence action, right, with a very small award of damages. So I think that, and I believe that Mr. Gentile actually said this. He quoted Judge Thompson in saying, look, we have to let it go because there could be nominal damages, even though Judge Thompson did not believe. And now I'm trying to go into Judge Thompson's mind. All I can see is what his eventual order was. But
in terms of the order granting new trial, he states specifically that his concern dealt with the estimate of $30,000 per month. But by the time Hightower had testified, there was a fairly specific collection number contained in the exhibit Mr. Gentile has described. Is that right?
And I do have one. I do have one thing to say about that, and I did raise this in my answering brief.
Yeah.
All right. And I do just want to make a quick record of it. I don't want to trounce on Mr. Gentile's argument here too much, but I did make an objection to the admission of that.
Now's a good time to trounce on his argument as best you can.
Yes, and that was something that they could have based their appeal on, but unfortunately they didn't include it in their appendix. I didn't have a chance to respond to that. What they did, the reason it's in the reply brief, all this testimony from Mr. Iglinski and everything, is because they, and I'm not going to say they forgot, whatever they did, it wasn't in their appendix. And I actually looked through there, and we didn't respond to it because it wasn't. I just noted in each one of these areas, and there were a couple, I believe the sanctions that we're talking about when it came to striking the expert report, I direct the court to that part of my answering brief as well. When the court made the decision to strike Mr. Zerga or Dr. Zerga, right, that part, that transcript was not in the record either, and I made an objection to that.
So yeah, the reference was that it came in, or it was indicated as an exhibit CCC. In the reply appendix, yes. All this testimony that Iglinski
yes.
provided about the 20%, is that part of
this?
I
know that Mr. Iglinski's testimony, and I'll let you finish the question.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
I know that Mr. Iglinski's testimony was in their reply appendix because I looked for it. You know, that was something that I felt the need to respond to, and you know, unfortunately, the court's rules are that if it's not in the if it's not in their opening appendix, that we can object to it, and the court should not consider that. So that is part of that. As far as the record that I had when I filed the answering brief, there was none of this. That makes sense.
Which goes back to the original position that the only thing demonstrated was revenue.
Yes.
And no no costs associated with generating the revenue, no profit calculation.
Yes, that is our argument, absolutely, right. In a nutshell. Now, when I think back to Mr. Iglinski's, just to respond to it, I don't want to give it more credence than it deserves, given our objection, but I still think that would have been our argument if the court were to read through it. I don't believe that the jury was capable of coming up with a reliable number for what Dr. Tenori's costs, for example, were, right? Because he was not willing to open up his books. This was an ongoing problem. See, we sent our computer person out there, and this is in our brief, right? And he was allowed access to, I guess, the computers that were on the outside of a cloud or outside of the computer where he where Dr. Tornay kept all of his records, but we couldn't get to the actual complete set of records. And I'm sure Mr. Gentile could respond to that more. The other issue they raised, just to get to that in their brief, was that Judge Thompson didn't review the record prior to making his decision on the new trial. And I didn't see any citation to authority. And Judge Thompson sat through the whole trial. Now, Judge Thompson, as Mr. Gentile said before, is a very experienced trial judge. And, you know, this was his opinion on this case. And truthfully, the reason that we went into arguing that JNOV should have been entered, right, is because when we read Judge Thompson's order, right, the first thing that pops out is that based on what he's saying, that there was not sufficient evidence presented to the jury, right, leads us to believe that Judge Thompson, based on his findings, made the wrong order.
But his order clearly says there's liability, and you didn't cross appeal. So how can we grant the judgment of NOV now on appeal?
As to damages.
Why would he wants to open up the order says open up discovery. Maybe you'll get into Tendori's books now that discovery is going to be opened again. Because I'm sure the Commissioner Bulla would help you out on that with severe sanctions if he won't open his books.
It's in Nye County, so it would be okay. Judge Thompson himself, you know, and he did try to help us out with that, and it didn't work. You know, I think our argument is that there's two components to, or there's multiple components to each cause of action, and if Judge Thompson came to the conclusion that there was no sufficient evidence of damages presented to the jury, right, then one part of one leg of their cause of actions failed.
But he didn't say that.
And I guess it concerns me going through the order, Judge Thompson's order. He clearly seems to be focused on the testimony that Tenery gave, indicating the $30,000 a month. And Mr. Gentile indicates, well, that wasn't our basis for damages. So can you explain that to me?
I think I can explain that. And again, this is trying to jump into Judge Thompson's head here, which I don't want to do too much. But I would ask the court to review our motion for a new trial, or our motion for JNOV. And I think that the facts that we cited in there, which we believe support that motion, really track Judge Thompson's order. And I think what he did was he took just our arguments and incorporated them into that order. But there were other reasons. And I know, obviously, the order controls, right? I think the hearing, which I can't cite anything directly from, but the hearing on the motion for JNOV and a new trial would be informative as to that. Appreciate you listening to me. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to come up here and argue.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sobol. Ms. Webster.
Is this the first time both of them are arguing?
May it please the court. Regarding the issue of whether the jury disregarded the instructions on damages, this court has said that the standard for that is whether this court is able to declare, had the jury properly applied the instructions of the court, it would have been impossible for them to reach the verdict that they reached. I would also like to let you know that we will provide the record site for Mr. Tenori's testimony regarding the 20% by letter tomorrow, if that's all right with this court. I would also like to address the issue in the supplemental briefing, which Mr. Stovall briefly raised. So in the supplemental briefing, this court asked whether Mr. Stovall can argue that the propriety of judgment as a matter of law when he was not able to have a cross appeal. And we submit that he cannot. This court cited to the Fields case which is a Missouri case, which allows a respondent to argue the propriety of judgment as a matter of law even when the respondent has not filed a cross appeal. However, that case and that entire line of authority is contrary to Nevada law. Specifically, as cited in our supplemental brief, this court in Ford in 1994 held that a respondent, unless they file their own cross appeal, cannot seek greater relief than what was afforded to them by the district court. In 2011, in Boonsong, this court reaffirmed that principle. In that case, the district court granted summary judgment on the issue of liability, and it was the damages award that was appealed. Without filing a cross appeal, the respondent, who was the defendant below, argued on appeal the propriety of the district court's summary judgment determinations of liability, and this court said we lack jurisdiction to consider that. Applying the rationale in Ford and Boonsong here, that is completely contrary to the Fields line of cases cited in Missouri. And further, even if this court were to apply the Fields line of cases, this is not the case to do that. Here, in Fields, in Missouri in general, and in Nevada as it has adopted the restatement, for a case, for a breach of contract case to be a submissible case such that it can survive judgment as a matter of law, one need only prove the existence of a contract and that it was breached. That's all you need to have a submissible case. You will at least be entitled to nominal damages.
Does the court's recognition, the trial court's recognition in the 50A discussion of the right, if liability was established, to nominal damages provide a basis for avoiding the judgment that the counsel's seeking here?
Yes, Your Honor. That is all you need to have a submissible case or a breach of contract. The standard for 50A or 50B is to present a sufficient issue to the jury. And we have done that here by presenting, they never argued that there was no contract. They never argued that there was no breach. They only argued that we didn't have enough evidence to show the damages that we sought.
What is troublesome, though, even assuming that a prima facie case has been demonstrated because of the right to nominal damages, is the court's reopening of discovery at line 2 and 3 of its order. I have to say, in a new trial order, that's pretty extraordinary. Did the court commit error in reopening discovery, or should this case be retried on the basis of the evidence that was presented?
Your Honor, we have enough evidence to provide the jury with a reasonable basis for reaching the verdict that it did. As Mr. Gentile outlined, the evidence produced by the defendants themselves showed the collections each month. When you combine that with Mr. Hightower's testimony of how much to allocate to money received based on the doctor's services versus other ancillary subjects, you can reach the number that Mr. Gentile reached in closing statements and that the jury substantially overlapped with. His number was approximately $600,000. The jury awarded $500,000.
Mr. Stovall has made an objection to raising the reference to the testimony in CCC in your reply brief. What say you with respect to that objection?
Your Honor, we in the opening brief did actually cite to that trial transcript. We referred to it as trial transcript of December, I believe, 9th or 10th, 2010. And then we supplemented that appendix with our reply brief.
So your contention is that the argument citing the specific collections that Mr. Gentile referred to was raised in your opening brief?
It was, Your Honor.
By citation to that trial transcript? Okay. Any other questions or any other argument you wish to make?
Your Honor, I don't have any further questions. I'm done.
All right. Justice Cherry has asked a question. I don't know the answer as to one. Is it the case, Mr. Stovall, that this is your first oral argument here and Ms. Webster?
Yes, Your Honor. I found out that I was doing the rebuttal when you did, so.
Ms.
Okay. I know Judge Perry was in Las Vegas by video.
Right.
This is certainly my first oral argument, but the three of you all.
Okay. Well, we just want to compliment you on your work, both of you, and recognize your initial performances before the Supreme Court and this panel.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
All rise.
Submit.
It's submitted.